Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us on WCTCAM or restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm fabulous. Well, how are you?
I'm all right. We have Rowan Jacobson coming on the show a little bit later.
Always a really good guest. Always.
One of my favorite authors. He's got a new book out. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But I want to start on a little more of an alarming note. There's some information that's come to light recently that I think gets my goat a little bit. It really does. Would you like to hear about it?
I would.
Here's an article that is published by the Center for Food Safety, which is a national nonprofit membership organization from about 1997. They're an environmental group. And in this, they quote some pretty serious facts. The headline, this is posted back in October 27th, 2010. The headline is, newly disclosed government documents conclude genetically engineered salmon pose a critical threat to marine environments. That's government documents.
Shocking.
But I thought the government was saying that genetically engineered salmon was fine. It should be pointed out that genetically engineered salmon will be the first animals of any sort that are genetically engineered and meant for human consumption.
And you know what that does for me?
What?
It alarms me.
Yep.
I'm alarmed, just like you.
The European regulating agencies of food are much less in the pockets of the European food companies and the big food companies, which are American, and they prohibit genetically engineered foods in a much, or they regulate them much more strictly than we do here in America.
Much more strictly than we do. Matter of fact, in some places they're not allowed, period.
And now, there is an application for the FDA to approve this genetically engineered salmon. Now, the genetically engineered salmon they're proposing to grow at this juncture, and I want to point out at this juncture, will be grown on land in places that aren't in the nets in the rivers or the oceans. However, once they're approved,
they will go into the ocean and go into nets, and what we know...
That's my guess.
And what we know for a fact is that some of the fish will escape the nets. That's just the way that works. I mean, right. it's not perfect.
Well, just so you know what kind of lobbying has gone on and how much the FDA is in the pocket of big business and big food, the FDA itself is required to do certain things rather than rubber stamp food, this kind of food, but it's not really doing its job. Here I'll read a little from the article. Adding in the new twist to the controversy over genetically engineered salmon, the Center for Food Safety revealed today, that's October 27, 2010, that in recent hearings on transgenic fish, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration knowingly withheld federal biological opinion by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
So, Francis, what would make them knowingly withhold that information?
Being in the pockets of big food.
So you think money?
It's a government organization. Now, we're not talking about a bunch of lefties here. We're talking about the FDA. Withholding information that came from another part of the U.S. government, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and NOAA.
You sure that that's not classified information that will affect us in our war against terror if we release it?
While the FDA applauded the company's choice of land-based containment as responsible, it never revealed that it is in fact illegal in the U.S. to grow genetically engineered salmon in open water pens. So in other words, the FDA said, oh yeah, there's nothing wrong with GE salmon. Nothing at all. Nothing. Let's see. We look around. Nope. Everything's fine. Except for two reports from the Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA. Than other parts of the U.S. government, not some lefty think tank.
It's not some independent person who's outside your jurisdiction, and you're not sure that their results are correct. Or this is people who are working for the government the same as you.
The biological opinion and supplemental information was obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request. In other words, we had to demand it. And it challenges the claims by Aqua Bounty Technologies. Love that. Aqua Bounty Technologies, the developer of the GE salmon, that transgenic fish pose no threat to marine environments, except that they do. Right? Now, these GE salmon are treated engineered with a growth hormone from an unrelated Pacific salmon and DNA from the antifreeze genes of the eel pout. And, see, the biological opinions are issued by the Food, Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA. And they were issued to the Army Corps of Engineers in 2003, and they expressed concerns that the salmon would, and this is a quote, threaten and adversely affect wild Atlantic salmon, which are currently on the endangered species list. Mm-hmm. Federal agencies are required by law to consult with the expert fisheries agency when any action may impact a protected species.
Well, here's the issue. Okay, you have species of fish. Here's what we know for a fact. Frequently, when you introduce a species of fish that does not belong in a certain part of the world, that fish can wreak havoc on the balance of the environment, on the balance of that fishery or air body of water. We're seeing that all over the place. You're seeing that with fish that are taking over certain bodies of water because they don't belong there in the first place, and they've been introduced artificially.
Here's a similar biological opinion issued by Food and Wine Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in 2001, and it also was held back and just released today. This is a quote from the report from the United States government. It's reasonable to assume that genetically modified salmonids possessing greatly accelerated growth potential and occupying the same habitat as wild fish would have a greater displacement impact on wild fish than non-transgenic domestic strains. In other words, if these things get out, they're going to outcompete
right.
The native stuff.
Which is already endangered.
The study further found that genetically modified fish survive better when there's a shortage of food. So they'll eat up all the food, and then there'll be a shortage of food, and then the regular salmon die off, but these guys stay alive, right? So the better survive when there's a shortage of food. They benefit more than non-transgenic fish from increasing water temperatures. And check this out. They can be more resistant to environmental toxins than – so do you know what that means? It means they'll – because with fish, we bioaccumulate toxins. So these genetically modified fish bioaccumulate. They're more resistant, so they live longer with these toxins, which means they have more of those toxins in their body before they die, which means when you catch those salmon and you eat that salmon, these salmons are more toxic than the regular non-genetically.
Could live in a more toxic environment thereby.
Okay, but the U.S. government is warning that, and, you know, the U.S. government is not particularly over-safety conscious when it comes to stuff like this. But this is stuff that's purposely being withheld. Check this final thing out, and then we'll bring this to an end. But it's just maddening. The documents.
Well, unfortunately, it won't be brought to an end.
Yeah,
it's still happening.
Just for today. The documents received make it clear that, check this out, even the scientists who came up with those conclusions, some data was kept from those scientists. Okay, so they didn't even have the
right.
complete
they didn't
picture.
Have the full picture, right.
And the FDA asked those scientists to sign confidentiality agreements so that they could never speak of the results of their studies. And the scientists, thank God these good people, refused to sign the confidentiality agreement. And they're like, it's science. We're studying salmon.
Right.
What could you possibly not want to know unless, of course, salmon's bad for you and you don't want people to know?
Salmon is not bad for you.
I'm sorry. Unless we find out that GE salmon shouldn't be approved and you don't want that information to get out there, why would they ask for a confidentiality agreement?
You know why.
Well, because look at...
Because the results aren't going to be the way that the American people would want them
to be. Or in case, because... You know they weren't going to keep it confidential if the results of the study were, hey, GE salmon's fine, put it out there.
Right.
They weren't going to keep that confidential.
Right.
There's only one
outcome that makes you want to keep it confidential.
Oh, my God. So the FDA still has not approved the use of genetically engineered salmon for human consumption. And
Thank you, FDA.
And we hope that, well, but they're trying, and we hope they don't. So you can call your local congressman and ask them to pressure the FDA not to approve GE salmon. That's what you can do on your part. If you like, we'll be back in just a moment talking about happy good things with Rowan Jacobson and his new book, American Terroir, in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTCAM and on RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys. Our guest today is a returning friend, scholar, and author, and a really interesting dude. Rowan Jacobson has written many books, A Geography of Oysters, Chocolate Unwrapped, The Living Shore, and he's been on our show to talk about all of those. And his latest book is just an awesome and interesting book, and it's the most exhaustive look at this particular topic I've ever seen. It's called American Terroir.
Rowan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here again.
What the hell is American Terroir, Rowan Jacobson?
And how the hell do you pronounce it?
And how the hell do you pronounce it? And don't say it at an airport. You know, terroir.
No, yeah, I have to be careful when I'm traveling.
You'd be a terroiriste. Oh, sorry. Okay.
I've been accused of that a few times.
So, American Terroir, what's it all about? What are you talking about, Rowan?
Okay, well, as I'm sure you guys know, terroir is a you know, everyday word in the wine world. It usually gets translated as taste of place or something like that. And what it's about is all the factors in a place that change the flavor of a wine or a food. So the environmental factors, the types of varieties of food being grown, a climate, and also the decisions made by the producers.
Let me interrupt with a clear-cut example of that I always use when I'm explaining terroir as it relates to fruit and wine. In wine, I will say to my students when I teach wine classes, in Burgundy, they only grow in the Côte d'Or in Burgundy, they only grow Pinot Noir. It's the only red grape they're allowed to grow. Sometimes you have winemakers that will make wine in two different villages. So say the village of Gevrey-Chambertin and the village of Moret-Saint-Denis. One of my favorite producers is a late Hubert Ligné. He used to work in those two villages. And he used to take the grapes from those two villages, keep them separate, and he would make a Gevrey-Chambertin and a Moret-Saint-Denis. And the only difference would be that the grapes had come from a different place. And yet experienced wine tasters in blind tastings could not only pick out his particular Moret-Saint-Denis and Gevrey-Chambertin, they could say, oh, this smells and tastes like a Moret-Saint-Denis, and pick it out as a wine of that village, because you could experience the taste and smell of that particular terroir in that wine, and the proof is in the blind tasting. And just the other example, on a much more humble level, Paul Hobbs, who's one of the most famous winemakers in the world, he grew up, his father was a farmer, and they had a lot of kids, and they were poor farmers for a long time. And he said, you know, his father used to be able to take an apple out of the basket, and when he bit into that apple, he could tell you what part of the farm, that the tree that apple came from was from. So that's the idea of terroir. Some people say it's a myth. I say nay. You agree, Rowan?
I don't think there's any question that it's real. The question is, how hard is it to tell, and where are those differences coming from? Which is kind of what inspired me to dig into that in this book. To me, it's the most fascinating thing. Like you use the classic example, Burgundy. Some of those vineyards, you know, a quarter acre apart from each other, totally different flavor profiles. So
yeah.
What's going on there?
I know, it's crazy, isn't it?
You know, we have a friend who makes wine out in California, and he kind of has the same philosophy, I think, of the folks from Burgundy. George Hendry is so maniacal in it. Now, he's grown up on this land. He's lived here for, 60, 70 years. And he's so maniacal about his property that he breaks it down into very, very small blocks. And he plants different clones and different grapes depending on that soil and each different block and how it's broken up.
When you get down to that micro level, it might not be – you almost can't make an economic argument for it, but you can sure as hell make an aesthetic argument.
Well, and plus it's fun because in his property, he's got a river kind of that runs through the back of his property through Napa.
Uh-huh.
And you can actually see, if you go around the back of his property, actually off of his property.
Into the riverbed.
Into the riverbed, you can see the different soil types and how one or another rises to the top rises to the top of the land, and how different soil types are developed throughout his property on different places. It's really fascinating to go look at.
Yeah, and it doesn't just happen with wine. We've sort of always associated it with wines, because not because there's anything special about grapes, but because wine has always had, you know, the best writers, the best thinkers. There's been more attention put into wine flavor than any other food or drink.
Well, and nobody ever pays $10,000 for a bottle of apple juice, but they do pay $10,000 occasionally
right.
for a bottle of wine. So it's the most examined agricultural product in the world, but what we find about wine is true about everything else. So, but we're talking about such levels of subtlety here. Why should we care, Rowan? I mean, why isn't just the stuff we buy off the supermarket shelves, an apple is an apple is an apple, why isn't that good enough? Is that bad for America?
Well, yeah. Well, that is a big question. I think we should care about terroir. And for me, personally, I know I respond to it because it connects me up with the landscape in a way that I find really rewarding. You know, I'm not a farmer, so it's kind of being able to live vicariously through farmers by tasting the foods and the drinks that they make. And when you pay attention to the uniqueness of a place, like what unique flavors that place can produce, then you definitely become more attached to that place. And I think pretty much everyone can agree that we kind of have this creeping phenomenon of placelessness in America, where sprawl is just expanding, and more places are becoming generic. And paying attention to things like terroir is a way to appreciate places that aren't generic and maybe try work a little harder to keep them that way.
Well, one of the things you mentioned in the book is why, and one of the reasons, frankly, I think that the book is so important is we need to preserve certain places because that's the only place that that particular product, you know, if you like the certain kind of honey, well, that certain kind of honey only comes from this certain kind of forest land that the honeybees pollinate, and if you get rid of that forest land, then it's gone. That honey doesn't exist anymore.
Exactly, and that's true of so many other things. There's a salmon I write about in the book that comes from the Yukon River Delta in Alaska. Completely different experience eating that salmon than eating a farmed salmon. So, you know, if you say, well, you know, salmon, so who cares if that, what happens to the delta up there? We've always got the farm salmon. It's a different experience and a different, you know, it kind of tells you something different about the world when you eat it.
We have to spend some time talking about Yukon River salmon because, actually, Francis and I have done a couple of shows on Yukon salmon.
Back from 05.
Way back when, we had a woman by the name of Diane Morgan on, and she wrote a book about Yukon salmon. And it's such an important place in the world, and it's doing such a special thing that I love that you would include it in this book, and I really want you to expound on what's going on in the Yukon River and why is there a sense of place there and why is it so important to preserve it and how are they doing that?
Yeah, you know, that was one of my favorite places I've ever been because the sense of place was so strong. And people kind of have this image of what Alaska is like, and this was not that kind of Alaska at all. There was no, it's a river delta out on the Bering Sea. So it's basically a gigantic, flat marshland. It's kind of like if you took southern Louisiana and moved it somewhere really cold.
Right.
So, you know, there's no big trees. There's no mountains and dramatic glaciers that you're looking at. It's a big, vast swampland. It opens onto the Bering Sea, which is one of the most productive seas in the world. That's why so many, that's why all the whalers went up to the Bering Sea, because there was just so much marine life up there. And today it still has a lot of the best salmon populations on Earth. And when those salmon are ready to spawn, they all return to their home river, the river they were born in, and swim all the way up that river to the streams at the head of it, and spawn there and then die. And when they make that spawning run, they don't eat at all during that journey, which is not a big deal if they come from one of the short rivers. But the Yukon River is over 2,000 miles long. It goes all the way through Alaska and then into the Yukon territories in Canada.
Just to give a quick example, some of the other rivers that we buy very expensive wild Alaskan salmon from might be 200 miles.
Exactly. I think Copper River salmon tend to go a few hundred miles upriver, something like that. And a lot of salmon just go just a few miles up rivers, especially the smaller species. But, so it's crazy. The Yukon River king salmon have to swim 2,000 miles upstream against a pretty strong current without eating. It takes them about 3 months to do that journey, I think. And what that means is that they have to have all their fuel on board when they begin that journey in the form of fat. So you catch them at the mouth of the river, and they are just unbelievably plump, rich salmon.
Because they have all that fat and fuel on board for the 2,000-mile journey, and if you get them there and you eat them, you get to eat that fuel, which is...
That's right. It's
which
like
is
them or you.
Delicious.
And if anybody's... And I presume that most of our listeners have not had Yukon salmon, but I was very fortunate in 05 when Diane was on the show. Shortly thereafter, we started running Yukon salmon every June until recently. Started running Yukon salmon in the restaurant, and... It is such a special fish that, and I'm going to let Rowan's had it even more fresh than I have, so I'm going to let Rowan talk a little bit about, you know, how that fish is compared to other salmon in the world.
Well, I like, Rick Moonen has a line about it. He says it's like the foie gras of the sea because it's so rich and soft like that. It's a different, one thing I learned is that you can't cook it like you would cook a normal salmon. Like if you try to grill, I tried to grill my first Yukon.
Fire.
Yeah.
There's fire. If you do that, there's so much oil in it. The fish, you got a lot of fire going on in that grill. Did you burn anything?
Fire you can't even put out.
Did you burn anything?
I'm sorry.
That's just when you said that, I was like, oh, no, don't do that.
Yeah.
Was it?
No, it was the end of that. But anyway, what I learned is cook it at a crazy low temperature, maybe 220 degrees, so that none of the fat breaks down. It all stays in the fish. You know, if you cook it for 30 minutes, 40 minutes, it's not going to dry out because of all that fat, and it just becomes, you know, sumptuous.
You know, you mentioned, too, that the Indian tribes that are up there seem very surprised that you would want to eat it as sushi or eat it raw.
Yeah, I just kind of assumed that they'd be into that, too, because and they just, you know, one of them said, man, I'm not that native. they don't do that. They smoke it all. But the only wood they have up there is this alder wood. It's like these little... 10-foot-high shrubs, and so they catch, you know, thousands and thousands of these fish in June when they're making their run, and then fillet them and cut them into these strips and hang them in these little kind of teepee-like, you know, smoking huts, and then just smoke them over the alderwood, and because basically that's the best food up there for the whole year. In winter, it's been picking, so they use that salmon to get through the winter when, you know, the occasional moose wanders by. But other than that, it's all salmon.
Occasional moose wanders in, but he doesn't wander out. Is that what you're saying?
Nothing. Anything that goes past gets... When I was in the village up there, you know, three seals were spotted in the river, and boom, before I knew what was happening, like 20 boats went out, and the seals came back.
and then there were none.
And then there were none, yeah.
You know, let's look at this whole issue, though, of good taste, because we talked about there are definitely differences. There's definitely subtlety. One of the themes that Mark and I always come back to in our talks here when we do any public speaking, we believe that good taste is revolutionary. And, you know, if we're talking about some very expensive salmon here, but it doesn't just apply to very expensive salmon. I think that good taste is important. I think that, like Paul Hobbs's father could taste the difference in the apples from one part of the farm to the other, which meant there were differences in food that you could taste, and we're not talking about things that are necessarily a lot of money. Having good taste is not effete. I think viewing food as a commodity and fuel for your body, or something that is a result of an advertising campaign, convinces you to eat it because it has a lot of sugar and fat in it, is we lose part of our heritage. We lose one of the great joys of being human and being alive. You know, the complexities of flavor and the richness that God put on this earth, or whoever you believe put on this earth, we have a responsibility to maintain it. And the commodification and the homogenization of food is not necessary. It's necessary if big corporations want to be able to produce a billion of something and make a lot of money. It's not necessary to feed the world. It's not necessary that we have to get our food this way. And I believe it's a crime if we let this nuance and subtlety go away. And one of the things that we dedicate a lot of our lives to is teaching people to appreciate the differences in food like this. I'm sorry, I got on my high horse there.
And what a strange time we live in that you have to teach people to appreciate that. Like, it drives me crazy when people believe that, you know, paying attention to flavor is an elite activity. Like,
right.
they act like somehow you've got a great example there. You know, the old timers who were working with the foods in an apple orchard or wherever, they could tell because it was part of their daily life. And it's just, we're in this weird little blip right now where people have lost connection to all that because corporations have sort of encouraged them to lose connection to that.
There's a powerful corporate interest to say, you know, okay, corporations can get you a red delicious apple, the cheapest, and has the most neutral flavor, so it's broadly appealing to everyone.
And it travels well.
So we have red delicious apples, and we have, you know, six or eight different varieties of apples in our supermarket. In every supermarket, the same six or eight varieties across the country. It didn't used to be like that, right?
Right. And, you know, there's nothing worse for corporations than people who pay too much attention to flavor, because flavor often doesn't travel that well.
Right.
Flavor's inconvenient sometimes.
And it's so, also, you can't market a national marketing campaign for something that's available in Washington in September, and then it's available maybe up through New York or into Canada by October, November, and then doesn't come back till next year, and is different in every place.
Seasonality is very inconvenient for your bottom line, you know?
You know what I heard on the radio once was really amazing? When Campbell's Soup, it was from that, I was listening to old radio on one of these stations that plays these old radio shows, and they play the old commercials, and it was a Campbell's Soup commercial from 1930-something. And you know what it said, which is unthinkable today? It was the people who were in the show putting on the radio play, then read the commercials live. And the guy said something like, Campbell's Soup in Camden, New Jersey has the tomato soup, which is the finest canned tomato soup in the land. This year's crop of tomatoes has been particularly good, so the Campbell's Soup on your shelf is... No corporation would ever recognize that...
There's a difference variance from year to year.
That the year could make a difference, you know? And I thought, wow, you know, how far we've come from that.
Right. Well, that's just shocking. But they felt like they had to do that at the time, but that's interesting. It's changed so fast in a way.
So let's talk about terroir and your book in just a moment when we come back. We have to take a short break for a commercial, but we'll be back in just a moment with Rowan Jacobson talking about his new book, American Terroir. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Stick around. We're going to talk about maple syrup. See you in just a moment. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of The Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. We're the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with Rowan Jacobson about his book, American Terroir. We talk about terroir in Europe as it applies to wine, but also, you know, the Europeans have always taken, and we used to take, the sense of place of a food very seriously. So it's not just about wine in Europe. So they have this, in France, they have an organization called the AOC, Appellation d'Origine Contrôlée. I know I've spoken French, immediately brands me as a liberal, but... I promise that's all I know. And the AOC certifies the provenance of food. So you can have AOC wines from all the different regions, but you can also have AOC butter. There are specific types of butter that are AOC butter, and other foods as well. There's ham, there's specific AOC jambon, and in Spain, there's a Denominación de Origen, is the same thing, and that's for the greatest Spanish hams. So this idea that a lot of food has a sense of place, and not just the most expensive food, is really maybe foreign only to us, and maybe it's only to this generation of us. It was never codified here, but our great-grandparents certainly had it. They certainly, didn't they, Rowan?
Oh, absolutely. And with certain, well, apples is a great example. Apples and cheeses used to be a very local phenomenon.
Well, you know, one of the things that you talk about is, and what happens in this book is Rowan picks about 9 different areas of uniquely American food that is as good as the most protected European AOC food or DO food, or DOC food in Italy, and you know, things that are worthy of protection. And maybe by printing this book and introducing more people to them, you've made them a little more protected. Let's talk about in your first chapter, which is called, quite lovely, In the Church of the North Woods, High Mountain Maple Syrup in Vermont. And you go into depth about how it's produced, why it's there, how it's a result of, you know, a silver lining to the cloud of the hardship of the cold northeast winters. Talk to us about maple syrup.
Well, yeah, it has a special place in all of us Vermonters' hearts. But and partly it's just because it's really good. But the other part is, like you say there, it's you know, you've gone through this really, really cold winter, and finally it's March, and the snow's beginning to melt, but it's still pretty nasty out. You know, days go up into the 40s, and they drop back to the 20s. But then, through the landscape on these dirt roads, you'll see these little buildings with peaked roofs and cupolas with steam billowing out of the cupolas, and that's the sign that somebody's in there boiling maple sap to make maple syrup.
Please.
And, you know, anytime somebody's doing that, there's kind of an unwritten rule that you can just stop in. And so suddenly you go from this really cold, wintry environment into this, like, kind of sauna-like environment with this great smell of maple syrup and the steam boiling out in the middle. And usually somebody's sitting around with beer or scotch. So
can you please tell us how this works and what these little shacks are? And they're not in your house. You don't do this in your kitchen, right?
And can I help you? There's no better sauna in the world than a maple syrup sauna.
maple sauna. The deal with maple syrup is maple syrup doesn't come out of trees, although some people seem to think that. There was actually The Onion had a false story a couple years ago that the reason that in Vermont we had to let all the sap out of maple trees is because otherwise they would explode in the spring. And I actually had a scientist, a smart guy on the West Coast, quote this to me as a real story. And he's like, I heard people are getting hurt by maple trees.
So really?
Only when they fall on your head.
Yeah. But what's actually happening is in the spring, the maple trees start basically pumping their sap up through the bark and up to their leaves. And so you drill a little hole in that sap and let it out into a bucket or now into tubes that run into a central collection tank. And that sap has about 2% sugar in it, which is normally the trees would be using to power themselves. But
so does it not? How does this not hurt the tree at all?
Well, the tree has more than it can use. So they've figured out basically how much you can take without hurting the tree.
Okay.
Which means one tap in a skinny maple, 2 taps in a big maple, maybe 3 taps in a giant maple, but that's it. And the rest of it, you know, you let the tree have. So you're not even taking, you know, 1%.
So it's the tree's donating a pint of blood.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
It's like giving blood. It's about that painful.
Okay.
You know, for a tree. Anyway, but then it's only got 2% sugar and then various minerals and other things, which are key to the flavor, but the rest of it's water. So then you just have to boil the heck out of that thing.
And do you know how far they boil it down?
Yeah, it's the rule is 40-1. Every 40 gallons of sap will give you 1 gallon of maple syrup because you have to get it down to a concentration of 67% sugar.
All right, so
at that point, it won't ferment into maple wine because the sugar is too high in there. It kills any kind of yeast. If you go farther than that, it gets too solid. There's too much sugar there, and it starts to crystallize out.
And then you get
candy. And people don't like that.
Exactly.
Well, let's talk about terroir. Let's talk about the different maple trees.
Before we talk about terroir, I have to share with you one example of a friend in upstate New York who was trying to get back to the land and trying to get green and didn't really know how to make maple syrup, but had some maple trees on their property in upstate New York. And they told me the story that they figured they were going to make maple syrup. And so what they did was they got a huge stock pot and put it on the stove in their house and started cooking down the maple syrup.
and it just created so much steam that the wallpaper steamed off the walls in the kitchen.
Yeah, that's like that is the classic like newbie mistake. That,
yeah,
they were not the first to do that.
Really, I didn't know that. I found it very amusing. They were not amused at all because it doesn't really stick back up again too easily.
It's a lot of steam. It really is.
So let's talk about, like Mark said, let's talk about, you know, are there different? Does honey taste different from different trees or different parts of Vermont?
You mean maple syrup?
Maple, yeah, that's what I meant.
Well, it is kind of like honey. It's the maple equivalent of honey. You know, it's a syrup.
Right.
Yeah, and there are absolute differences. And everyone's always known that, you know, every little, you know, maple grower had a different tasting syrup, but no one ever really thought about why until recently. And partly, just like with wine, part of it is the, you know, the terroir, the natural environment, and partly it's technique. It's whatever, you know, production is being done. But in terms of environment, the differences seem to come from the bedrock, whether you've got limestone or shale. Well, because soil is basically just weathered rock,
mm-hmm.
and with a little organic material mixed in. And depending on what type of rock you have, you're going to have completely different minerals, which the trees all take up through their roots. So you can get very different mineral profiles in the maple syrup based on what type of bedrock you have.
And just in case you're wondering, if you think, oh, that sounds a little bit fancy for maple syrup, it's the same thing that expresses itself in grapes. Why would we expect not to see it in maple syrup? And then further, we don't concentrate grape juice by 40 times, you know, so whatever expression of terroir is in grape juice, you know, you get almost as much wine as you had grape juice to start with. With maple syrup, you take whatever's there and you multiply it by 40 times concentration. It makes total sense that there would be differences from place to place.
Because of that concentration process, you get some really unusual, rich flavors in there.
And I like the example you use in the book where you're talking about, you know, one set of trees has a particularly high sugar content, so that gets boiled down maybe only 30 times. And one set of trees has a particularly low sugar count, so that gets boiled down 60 times. And so those other trace minerals become much more apparent in the one that you're boiling down 60 times than the one that you're boiling down 30 times because of the sugar contents.
Right, which is kind of counterintuitive, although, again, it matches what we know from the wine world, which is that stressful environments tend to produce really good tasting stuff. So what I've learned with maple syrup is to seek out some of these guys who are growing in sketchy environments, like up way up high in the Green Mountains, where the soil's really thin and it's extra cold, and that stress makes the trees not able to produce as much sugar. And what that means is that when you concentrate it, you're getting like a 60 times concentration instead of a 30. So you've got extra bang for your buck.
So do the maple tree evolve in the Northeast only, or and it's a response to being in a very cold environment? Talk us about the maple tree. You have some interesting points you make in the book.
Yeah, you know, the only place in the world that can make good syrup is kind of like this big triangle. I think in the book I said it started all at Wisconsin, but then I just got these irate emails from my Minnesota maple syrup producer. So I'm going to push the point of the triangle over to Minnesota. Basically, Minnesota down to West Virginia in the Appalachian Mountains a little bit, and then up into the Canada, into Quebec. That triangle is where all the world's maple syrup comes from. And for some reason, even in other cold environments, like in Russia and stuff, they've tried it, and it's just undrinkable.
But the trees survive, but they don't make good syrup.
Yeah, there's something different about their lifestyle. Sugar maples, like you can make syrup from almost any kind of tree, but most of them just have all these really nasty compounds in them that make them undrinkable.
I had a pine bark resin, which is used as a medicinal in Austria.
I'll bet that was delicious.
You know what? It was actually kind of interesting.
Oh, quiet! You like all sorts of disgusting things.
Maybe like you might want to just drizzle a little with that.
It wasn't maple syrup, but you could actually make a tea out of it, and it made you feel better. It sort of opened you up aromatically. But you know, you wouldn't put it on your pancakes. I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, I've made tea out of pine needles, and no, that's not bad, actually.
Interesting. You're a dork, too. That's great. That's super. We should have lunch.
I've surrounded myself. Someone get me out of the radio station.
So,
save me.
So let's we'll leave maple syrup in just a moment. Let's just compare and contrast, though,
Mrs. Butterworth's or Log Cabin. There's no log cabin in the log cabin. You know, corn syrup, basically, with maple syrup. How in the world did we get to where most people have corn syrup on their pancakes?
Well, that's the thing that I just don't understand, because I grew up with maple syrup. And the other product, if you buy syrup in a store, it actually doesn't have a drop of maple in it, because maple syrup is very expensive because of that boiling process, mainly.
Right.
It's just corn syrup, and don't get started on corn syrup. Plus a little artificial flavoring that comes from various weird places. But do you guys remember there was this big deal where a couple of years ago there was these maple smells were wafting over Manhattan every now and then?
Yeah. Because I used to live in Jersey City, and as you drove over the Newark Bay, it was only at night really that I would smell them. What was that about?
It turned out it was. It took a couple of years for the authorities to track down the source of the aroma, but it was a some sort of herb or perfumery plant in New Jersey that was, I think it was using fenugreek, something about...
Oh, okay.
And something...
That makes sense.
One particular compound in the fenugreek was, like, escaping and had what people thought was maple. So that's kind of like the artificial maple.
Interesting.
Flavor.
Well, fenugreek, I don't know if everybody knows this, if you take a lot of fenugreek, and it's actually something that breastfeeding mothers are supposed to take, it will make your perspiration smell like maple syrup.
Really?
Yeah, little known dumb fact. And actually, if you're a breastfeeding mother, will make your breast milk more appealing to the baby because it will taste like maple syrup.
Note to self, buy Mark fenugreek for Christmas.
So I smell better when I sweat.
So you smell better when you sweat. We often share a car, do long drives together. All right.
So then we tied that up in a nice little bow, didn't we?
Wow, I'm still thinking about the maple-flavored mother's milk. That's
Yeah. Yeah,
stop thinking about it. You're creeping me out a little bit, Rowan.
All right, I want to talk about one other thing, Rowan, because your books are always. I mean, I'm pretty much of a food geek, and I read, you know, where things come from and where they fit in society and evolutionarily. But every time I read one of your books, first of all, they're fun and easy reads, and I learn something with every chapter.
What I noticed about it is it could be a textbook that reads like a novel.
Yeah,
it's packed with information. And things that I want to know, but it reads like a novel. It reads like I don't want to say telling a fiction because it's true, but that's how it reads.
And this one has pictures.
Well, you know, you sit there in your little room writing your little book, and the big fear every day is making people bored. So.
Well, yours doesn't do that. I want you to cover, and we're running up against time here, but I would love for you to talk about your chapter on avocados and how avocados are a crazy fruit that don't make any sense.
Yeah, well, avocados are a fruit, right? If you think about almost any fruit you can think of, what's the overarching taste profile?
Sugar.
Wheat.
Right.
Basically, a fruit is a way of convincing an animal to spread that plant seeds around. Like, it's a bribe. The animal comes along, eats the sweet part of the fruit, and spreads the seeds around for the plant, which can't really do a very good job usually of spreading its seeds around because it's rooted in place.
Except for the Day of the Triffids, those plants walked. I don't know if you remember the terrible old B movie from the 70s.
You are fired.
Sorry. I'm sorry.
Get out.
Go ahead.
There are some weird strategies that plants have come up with. But anyway, one of them is the avocado. It's the only, pretty much the only fruit I can think of that instead of going the sweet route, and sugars are pretty cheap to make in terms of energy.
Expenditure of energy.
Yeah, it's an easy giveaway, which is why, you know, sugar is the standard giveaway, the lollipop at the bank. It's like, here, have a, you know, cheap sugar. But fat is a lot harder to make. For some reason, the avocado tree decided that its whole key to success, its game plan, was to make these incredibly fatty fruits that had absolutely no sugar in them. And that's why an avocado is a calorie bomb. And for an animal that can deal with one of those things, it's a little treasure trove of nutrients.
So it has no acid, it has no sugar, it's very unusual in that it contains a lot of fat, which we normally don't look to find in a vegetarian diet, but it was very prized by the Native Americans or Native South Americans because of because precisely their diet was so vegetarian. This was for them a cheap source of fat. Yes.
Yeah, it was pretty much their best source of fat. They didn't have it. Kind of a different environment. The tropical environments don't tend to have the giant grazers that you get on grasslands and that we've kind of built a lot of our cuisines around.
No buffalo, no cows.
Yeah.
And plus an avocado you don't have to chase.
Yeah, it's slow. It's relatively slow.
Yeah.
So like an avocado is just, I love any sort of plant or animal that comes up with a completely different way of doing something. And the avocado is one of the great examples of that.
Well, you give a statistic in your book that I have, that I'm reading right now. You say an acre of avocado trees can produce, 1 acre can produce 8 tons of fruit per year. That's pretty prolific.
Yeah, these trees, and the place I write about in the book is Michoacán, Mexico, which is the avocado growing capital of the universe, because it's got the perfect climate for them. And that's also pretty much where they evolved, that, central highlands of Mexico. But, they produce more fat per acre than olive trees in Europe do. And that's I kind of think of them as kind of like the olive tree of Mexico.
Well, and here I have more statistics here that you said it's twice as many tons of fruit as an acre of olive trees, and with an average oil content in the avocado of 25%, that's 4,000 pounds of fat out of an acre of land. That is a buffalo.
Yeah, there you go.
You grow a buffalo.
You can either have the avocado tree or the buffalo.
Yeah, exactly.
Basically, the land can do either one, yeah.
That's pretty cool stuff, man. Well, I learned something every time I read your books, Rowan. And,
really fascinating.
And this was
really,
a great one.
Really fun and fascinating book.
This is a great one.
It's always great fun to be here, you guys.
You're a champion of important stuff. Rowan Jacobson's book is American Terroir. You can find out about it at therestaurantguysradio.com. Please go there and buy it. Rowan, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks again. You guys are the best.
We'll be back. The best, who have just been pronounced the best by Rowan Jacobson. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. Mark and Francis, the restaurant guy. God, that guy is smart.
You're just one of my favorite guests on the show. Rowan always is intelligent, and his books are always interesting.
Well,
let's face it. We get a lot of books to read.
Yeah.
Some people who never appear on the show, some people who do. Rowan's books are always my favorite ones to read.
Well, and also, many of his books are talking about tragedies and crises and different things we need to take action on.
He's working on one for the BP oil spill.
Yeah,
right
that
now,
should
so.
Be a good one.
I guess
but,
that's going to be
but
less
this
fun.
But this is a Rowan Jacobson happy book. There's nothing unhappy about this. We didn't say there were recipes in the back of each chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can pick up this stuff and how to use it. It belongs in your bookshelf, in your kitchen. Get it. Anyway, I hope you guys have enjoyed this hour as much as we have. We are The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys. You're listening to us on WCTC-AM and restaurantguysradio.com.